Prescriptions for Health with Dr. Len and Vicky Saputo. Mondays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Monday, November 28th, 2011. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicky Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com every Monday live from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time and from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And remember that our shows are archived on DrSaputo.com and also on PRN.fm.
Today you're going to hear Vicky's 2020 health tips at 20 after the hour and 22 the hour. And we got a really good show for you today. It's going to include something about over-the-counter medicines that can be fatal with just a little extra.
And can cancer screening be harmful? Is it being overdone?
And do we need low-dose Ambien for interrupted sleep? Is this a good idea? What we need is one more sleeping pill out there on the market?
And how much exercise do we need to help us sleep?
And what about dreaming? You know, in our sleep, it really acts overnight as therapy. It's like taking the edge off difficult memories, and we're going to talk about some of the simple biochemistry that explains it.
But you're not exercising in the middle of the night.
That's for sure.
And we have a lot more. Plus, if you want to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. You know, it sounds harmless, but regular use of just slightly too much Tylenol can be fatal.
Yeah, just a little bit more. If you take about three times what's recommended on the label, if you do that for some time, it gradually will get after your liver to the point where you'll have liver failure and need a liver transplant a lot more often than you think.
And, you know, that's easier said, I mean, easy to do, because you know how the ads used to say to take two Tylenol and, you know, call your doctor or whatever. But
two aspirin was more common.
But, you know, then they increased the dosage of Tylenol, and then people were still taking two of the extra strength Tylenol.
Plus, they may be taking it in a lot of other medications.
Yeah, you know, like cough medicines and cold medicines and all that. You know, a lot of times they just add it in Vicodin.
So what happens when you take a little too much Tylenol? Basically, you're talking about wearing the liver down. See, our liver is our main detoxification organ. And if we abuse it by drinking too much or by having had hepatitis of some type or just taking some drugs that require a lot of detoxification, and there are so many environmental toxins in the environment anyway that our livers are challenged.
Especially if you drink alcohol.
Yeah. So if you overdo it and you're older, the chances of getting a severe case of liver failure that requires transplantation is not just a myth. It's for real. A single dose of Tylenol that's used, say, for someone who wants to commit suicide, you'd need about 12 to 15 grams of it in one single dose, and that will do it. But if you're going to pick a way to go, this isn't the way to pick, because chances are it's a slow, miserable death, and you'll probably wind up with a liver transplant. So you don't want to do that. If you're going to commit suicide, you better find something that works a little faster is more sure.
And you know, too, a while back when a few people were dying from the H1N1 flu, there's some thought that it might have been from the Tylenol that they were taking when they had the flu.
Well, it could have been
from the flu itself.
Well, you know, we have a tendency to just keep taking more. And if you think something like Tylenol or aspirin is safe, and if you just take a little bit more, it's not going to hurt anything. And the thing that's on your mind is, how do I relieve my pain? I mean, that's the biggest thing that's on your mind. And that's how it happens. And I'd say in old people, in people, say, over the age of 65 who use alcohol, you see about 60% of the cases of liver failure coming from that group. And the failure that they get is a lot worse, and the mortality is higher than if somebody's just taking a single big dose.
You know, too, a lot of times people take Tylenol instead of aspirin because they know that aspirin makes you bleed.
Yeah.
But guess what? Too much Tylenol can make you bleed, too.
Take 2 grams a day, and you'll have as much bleeding as you will with aspirin. And that's easy to do because if the tablets are 350 milligrams each, or 325, and you take 2 4 times a day, you're there.
And that's not the extra strength kind.
No, that's just a straight dose. So now, let's say you are taking too much Tylenol. Let's say your liver is inflamed and you go to the hospital. What's the first thing they're going to do to you? They're going to give you some N-acetylcysteine, which is an amino acid that works to detoxify in the liver. There are 4 pathways for detoxification in the liver. You've got glycine, which is used in a situation for aspirin overdose because it's glycine that conjugates with acetylsalicylic acid and converts it into something inactive. It's N-acetylcysteine that works with Tylenol. And then there's sulfate and glutathione that does the job for a lot of other kinds of things that we put into our body that we shouldn't. So N-acetylcysteine is the answer to the challenge, at least as a first step, but it doesn't guarantee that you're not going to get into trouble with it. What always stuns me is that there are ads, the direct-to-consumer ads that say, what medicines do doctors use most to relieve pain in the hospital? And the answer was Tylenol, acetaminophen. And the last place you'd want to use Tylenol is in the hospital, in my viewpoint, because a lot of people are already toxic and the liver is over, has a job that's bigger than it would like to detoxify. So you add a little Tylenol to it, or a lot of Tylenol to it, you're going to have a bigger problem with detoxification. And you know, that's one of the things in medicine that we don't have a lot of respect for as doctors. We're not trained to think in terms of detoxification, we should.
And when you have liver problems like this that are so serious, it can affect your kidneys and your central nervous system, like your brain, and it can also affect your respiratory system, your lungs, and so forth.
I've seen people who have this problem and have needed liver transplants. It's a messy, nasty thing, and it takes a long time to die from that. So,
well, this is where it comes in, you know, handy to know about alternatives for pain and mm-hmm. for fever and whatever other reason you would be taking Tylenol for.
Right.
Because sometimes a fever's not a bad thing. It's your body's way to try to fight something.
Yeah.
Unless it's, like, way high, like 106 or something.
Well, we tend to overdo everything when we hurt. And what we want is relief. And we have the misconception that aspirin and Tylenol are two very safe things. And they are fairly safe if you take them in low dose, but you could even question that, especially with the case of aspirin, which is why I'm always saying I don't think we should be taking an aspirin a day to prevent heart attacks and strokes, unless we've had one already.
And look at the ingredients of other medications, like we mentioned earlier, because many of them contain the acetaminophen as well. So,
right. Now, you might be interested to know that aspirin, Tylenol, and drugs like Vioxx, which is now, thank God, off the market, inhibit the production of energy by the cell. And the way they do that is to block the production of ATP, which is the energy currency of the cell, that's much like gasoline is to a car. And it does that by slowing it down and keeping the mitochondria from being able to make as much energy as we need. Then you've got more problems because you don't have the energy you need to repair things. So the whole business of Tylenol or acetaminophen is a big deal, and we should be very careful about doing things that are like that. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888, and we have a call from Barbara. Hi, Barbara, are you there? Hello, Barbara?
Yes, doctor, he doesn't do any of that. This is caused from being extreme anemia, iron deficiency.
So who doesn't do any of what?
This Tylenol business. He doesn't do it. My husband, that's sick, he doesn't do any of this with the yellow jaundice.
Oh, that's for sure. In fact, there are a few medicines he can take safely if his liver is so damaged that it's jaundiced. Do you know why it's jaundiced, Barbara?
Well, yes. The doctors diagnosed him as anemia deficiency, iron deficiency.
Iron deficiency?
He has a blockage in the bile duct that prevents, you know, a little digestion. And 5 years ago, he was diagnosed with this, the blockage, obstruction.
Do you know what the obstruction is caused by?
Well, now several doctors. He's a veteran, and we go to the Veterans Hospital here. He's had quite a few transfusions. You talk to five different doctors, and all five of them will give you a different answer.
Isn't that frustrating, Barbara? When you talk about jaundice, you're talking about different mechanisms that cause it. One is liver failure, for sure.
Yes.
Another one would be blockage of a bile duct so that the bile can't get out.
Yes,
and the third one that comes up that you've raised is if you're anemic and your blood is being destroyed, hemolyzed, much faster than it should. And I don't know which. He certainly has obstruction because you've said that.
Yes,
and if they're giving him multiple transfusions, he probably has a hemolytic anemia on top of that.
Yes.
Now, does he have pain now, Barbara?
No, thank God we're blessed that way, Doctor. He has been so blessed with no pain, no nausea, no throwing up. Now, we did 5 years ago, the doctor said something about a tumor, a gastric tumor there. So we went ahead and did the radiation and the chemo, and it evidently helped. He started gaining weight and eating good, and then about just a few months ago, he started losing weight and not much of an appetite, and started losing quite a bit of blood going somewhere, so I took him, rushed him back to the emergency room. So this is what's been going on.
He may, Barbara, be bleeding from this thing if it's in the stomach.
Yeah,
and it's possible that the cancer has made its way to the liver or to the bile ducts, or it could be causing obstruction.
They ran some tests, and thank God it stayed isolated. His other organs, were so blessed that respect, that his liver is good, his kidneys is good, he poops good, and he just, he's bedridden right now because he's extremely weak.
Well, see, there are a lot of things you could do here outside of the mainstream that involve supporting wellness. And one of the things I like to talk about is making sure he gets good nutrition.
Absolutely.
Because without the right nutrition, and the right nutrition for somebody who has what he has, you'll be in trouble. You could see a good nutritionist, or you could see somebody who's a naturopath,
or if you find a
doctor who happens to know something about nutrition. They're called orthomolecular doctors. That's a real good thing to start with. There are a lot of things to support the GI tract with. Things like probiotics and L-glutamine and ultra-clear sustain and quercetin, there are a lot of things like that that should be considered.
Right.
I want to be sure you don't get the idea that I'm giving you advice. I'm not.
No,
what I'm doing is giving you ideas to think about.
I'm a nutritionist myself. We had a nutrition health food in here in Las Vegas for many years, and his nutrition is super. We've always been active, exercise, walking. We don't
That's
eat
good.
Junk food. We do yoga, meditation, Tai Chi, all this. That's why we got friends with
Francisco.
Are
you doing any complementary and alternative things for the cancer itself?
We're doing, I'm doing the astragalus, the milk thistle. I'm doing CoQ10. I'm doing some vitamins.
Okay, those are good things for liver support.
Minerals.
I'm talking about the cancer itself. There are some good doctors in Nevada
really
who
truly,
you might want to consider seeing, and I'm going to give you a name.
The only thing that I've been doing...
Have you got a pencil handy, Barbara?
I sure do.
Okay, the name of the doctor I have in mind is in Carson City. His name is Frank Schallenberger. And you can look him up on the internet and call his office. And if you can't make it there because your husband's too weak, he may have some ideas of other doctors that are where you live.
He cannot, do for himself at all right now.
No, I understand, but I'm trying to help you with some solutions. The other thing I would suggest you do is go to my website at Dr. Saputo. That's D-O-C-T-O-R, Saputo, S-A-P-U-T-O.com. And look up some alternative therapies for cancer. There are quite a few on the site that you should be knowledgeable about, and maybe give some thought to working with someone who does integrative treatment for cancer.
Well, and I think, Doctor, that the most important thing right now is this this bile duct and this jawness.
They can put a stent in there to try and open that up.
I believe, and so does Richard, that the cancer is gone. I believe that that's not the problem.
I can't give you any more suggestions to consider, Barbara, and I want to thank you for calling.
Okay.
Because I think you have a complicated thing there. Go to the website I suggested, drsaputo.com, and check it out, because there are a lot of approaches that you can consider with your doctors that might add to some of the things you're doing. There are things like artemisinin and methyljasminate and a lot of nutritional things that can support that. So I hope that's of some help for you. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, talking about cancer, you know, it's time to stop selling cancer screening, because we need to be publicizing both the harms and the benefits that go along with that, and the harms are downplayed.
Well, they really are, you know, and it's criminal in a lot of ways that we're out there saying, oh, you have to have your mammogram if you're under the age of 50, and if you get to be 50 years old, you should have a colonoscopy, and if you are a man, you should have PSA tests, and if you want to be sure you don't have lung cancer, periodically you might think about doing a CT scan.
And getting the mammograms.
Yeah, and every one of those things is not true. I mean, you absolutely do not need to have a mammogram under the age of 50 under normal circumstances, because the test causes more problems than it solves. We wind up making too many diagnoses of something called DCIS, which is not really a cancer except 2% of the time. So 98% of people who have DCIS are not going to die from their cancer, but they may die from the treatment, because the treatment for it is chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery. And so 98% of those people are getting overtreated big time, and the only people that are really happy about this are the radiologists, the surgeons, and the pharmaceutical industry, because they're the ones who have a conflict of interest and are making tons of money. So when
we
search,
not to say anything about the anxiety that it's causing for these women.
Well, that's really right, and that's
and their
on top
families.
Of it. And it's the same thing for the PSA test, the prostate specific antigen test, which is used for prostate cancer screening. You know, back in the late 80s, everybody thought, the doctors included, and Thomas Stamey, the urologist from Stanford, who invented the test and brought it forward, thought this was a great test because it was going to find those cancers early. So we could cure everybody. And what Thomas Stamey says today is that the PSA era is over. And why? Because we're finding too many cancers that are just like DCIS in the breast. About 2% of them will kill you, and the other 98% we're going to overtreat.
And it panics these men, and they end up getting, you know, their prostates removed and becoming incontinent, and they don't have any
sexual function. Yeah, well, a lot of them, that's right. So, again, overdoing it is what we don't want to do. So the standard of practice today amongst most doctors who are reading the literature is not to do a PSA for screening unless you already know you have cancer. Then it becomes invaluable, because it tells you how active the cancer is. If that PSA is rising, you know that that cancer is getting out of hand. But if you're screening an asymptomatic person with a PSA test, you know, about 25% of cancers have a normal PSA, a normal PSA. 50% of those PSAs that are above 4, which is the upper limit of normal, and maybe as high as 10 or 15, aren't cancer. So we wind up way over-diagnosing and over-treating, enough so that the medical profession has now taken a stand and saying that's not a test to use for routine screening.
And last week we talked about colonoscopies.
Right.
And how those were so overdone. And actually they're recommending now that you not get a colonoscopy unless you have a family history or you have symptoms that
would
warrant it, rather than to just do it routinely.
Right. For asymptomatic screening, it's not the test to do, because you'll wind up causing perforations and you'll be causing GI bleeds that put you in the hospital and require taking transfusions 1 in 200 times. And 1 in 200 times, you're also going to find a problem that you'll be glad that you found. But if you take vitamin D and or your vitamin D levels are normal and you're fit exercise-wise, the chances are your risk is more like 1 in 400 or 500, which means that it's not worth doing a colonoscopy as a routine screening thing.
The same thing with CT scans to detect lung cancer.
Exactly. And we can go on with this, but it's time for your 2020 tip, Vicki. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's first 2020 tip.
I have a few little things about old age.
All right. A little humor again?
Yeah, a little humor.
Our best medicine.
Humor is the best medicine. That's right. Well, there's this old lady, and she phones her doctor's office, and she says, is it true that the medication that you prescribe has to be taken for the rest of my life? The doctor's like, yeah, I'm afraid so. And then she's quiet for a minute, and then she says, I'm wondering then just how serious is my condition, because this prescription is marked no refill.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, the rest of her life might just be 2 weeks, huh?
You know, I want to quote a few people, like Gloria Swanson. She says, I think all this talk about age is foolish. Every time I'm a year older, everyone else is, too.
That's true.
And this is from Fred Astaire. To me, this is the best one. Old age is like everything else. To make a success of it, you've got to start young. But isn't that the truth about taking care of ourselves?
Well, you know, absolutely. I know I've had problems myself with my hip because I played tennis all these years, probably my whole life since I was 16, and now I'm a senior citizen for sure. And if it hadn't been for being in shape, I'm not sure I would have survived all the complications that I had from two hip surgeries on the same hip.
You might not have had to have the hip surgery either.
Well, if I had played tennis.
You hadn't done that. Well, but no, we've talked about studies not even very long ago about how it makes a difference when people are very young and kids and so forth, the exercise they get.
Oh, it prevents osteoporosis, hypertension, yeah, diabetes, obesity. I mean, the heart attack, strokes, it just goes on and on.
Well, here's one from Ingrid Bergman. She says, old age is like climbing a mountain. You climb from ledge to ledge, and the higher you get, the more tired and breathless you become, but your views become more extensive.
Isn't that so?
And we've all heard this one from Betty Davis, that old age is no place for sissies.
That's true.
Age is a question of mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter. And this is from Malcolm Forbes. By the time we've made it, we've had it.
You know, I haven't talked to too many people in their 90s that really fear death. They're saying, I've had enough. You know, I don't like it in this place where I live anymore.
Except for
everybody's died.
Yeah, but you know what? When it really comes down to it, if they're having chest pain or whatever it is, they're scared and they're going to call 911.
That's true. You know, a study was done on that was reported just this week. It talked about how people who are in congestive heart failure feel about dying. And the great majority of them, even when they're in the process of dying, said, I want you to do everything to save me. Because it wasn't quality of life. It was not quality of life. It was length of life that mattered to them. So you're making a good point.
And last but not least, from Bill Cosby, he says, don't worry about senility. My grandfather used to say, when it hits you, you won't know it.
That's true. There's nothing like losing everything you've got, which is gradually what inevitably will happen to everybody if you live long enough. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
So do you want to talk any more about cancer screening, or you think we're done?
I think we pretty much got there. We just maybe one more point, and that's that the public is really pretty brainwashed, and they think that these screening tests that we have are really important to do, and they're really religious. It's like a ritual.
Like turn 50, you go right away and go get your
colonoscopy if you don't, they feel
and
guilty.
Your mammogram.
And at age 40, they're getting their mammograms, and the PSA is starting at 40 or 50. And a lot of people were doing these total body scans, you know, the Ameris scans that were being done, which now are only done in extreme situations when people are sick and we can't figure out what's going on, because a lot of people are getting cancer from this. You do about 1,000 of these tests on people, one person's going to get cancer from it.
And you know, there are people that have cancer in them. And it ends up just going away. They've figured this out, and they've figured it out in autopsies, too. A lot of people die with it rather than from it.
Well, here's an example for you.
Why
if you autopsy women's breasts over the age of 50 that die for other causes, about a third of them will have cancers there that are fairly substantial. And yet, not a third of them have cancers that are going to kill people. They die from something else, and the cancers must go away. Another study that was done years ago was when the radiologists were doing mammogram studies on women over a five-year period. And they did it at the beginning, year three and year five in one group, and in the other group, they just did it at year five. And the difference in cancer rates was substantially lower and the people who only had one mammogram. It was about out of 2,000 people who had cancer, this is 100,000 people in the study, 2,000 of them actually had a cancer if they did it at the beginning, year three and year five. And there were only 1,500 if they only did one at year five, which means the other 500 went away. So between the autopsy results and studies like this, we know that not all cancers are going to come out and kill us. Because they just don't do that.
What we're doing is we're selling by fear and persuasion rather than on education. And the public is so brainwashed now that they start thinking that the services are being withheld if they're not offered.
I know. When this big thing came out, the United States Preventive Task Services came out with a statement saying that they didn't feel that everybody at age 40 should have a mammogram. Because of the reasons I spoke about earlier. And there were people uprising from everywhere, particularly the American Cancer Society and the radiologists and the pharmaceutical companies didn't have to say a word because they own the American Cancer Society. And it was all about money on their part. And yet, there were people who were furious in the general public. Women in the general public were saying, yeah, all you're trying to do is take away another screening test that might save our life. Of course, that wasn't the truth at all, but that was the message that came across. And that's substantiating that when we get brainwashed about something, we get illogical a lot of the time, and we just do what we're brainwashed to do.
And we don't even realize we're brainwashed.
No, we don't.
But think about all the ads and things we see on TV and...
business
of
medicine.
And actors and so forth talking about things that they don't know anything about.
Oh, Sally Fields, I love her as an actress, but she's a moron when it comes to this business of osteoporosis and using something like Boniva or Fosamax or any of the other ones.
Well, it's probably just a job, you know?
Well, it is a job, but I mean, that's taking advantage of people, and it's giving them the idea that this is the right treatment for people who have osteopenia, which isn't even a disease, or osteoporosis, when we should be doing the first things first. Do your regular exercise. Don't drink or smoke. Make sure that you're taking enough vitamin D and vitamin K. Maybe take a little strontium if you want to do some bone building, and take a little bit of calcium. That's the way to treat somebody who has bones that are on the thin side but still in the normal range, and for those that have outright osteoporosis. And in my experience, I've seen wonderful results using that over decades now. I haven't used a drug like Boniva or Fosamax in probably 20 years, which is how long it took me to you know, I was in practice about that long before I figured it out, that isn't the right way to go. And it's a way with a lot of drugs. We go ahead and we prescribe them because we read the ads that are in medical journals. We read the journal articles that are produced by the big pharmaceutical industry that are lying about things.
Everybody ignores all the possible adverse effects.
Well, that's for sure. And it's the same thing with things like the statins. I mean, they're way overdone. You start talking about using statins in primary care, and I just start going berserk because that's the last thing you want to do. You have to take 100 people and treat them for 5 years every day with a statin to prevent one heart attack in people that don't have a history of a heart attack or a stroke. And that doesn't make any sense.
And you know what else is? All these medications end up in our water.
That too.
They do. And so we end up taking them whether we want to or not.
You're right. You're making such a good point. All right. The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888, and we'll be back taking your calls after a short station break. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we have a call from John from Oregon. John, are you there?
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, I've been better, but I'm hanging in.
Well,
I just wanted to kind of follow up on a comment you made almost in passing last week about how medicine has now become a business.
Oh, yes.
I believe it was in 1973, Richard Nixon made a speech in which he announced that it was the official policy of the United States government that medicine was a business like any other business.
Oh, my gosh.
Do you remember that?
I don't remember that, but it's too bad he said that.
Yeah, well, he did, and not a single Democrat argued the point. And as far as I don't know what the documentation is that accompanies his proclamation, but it's obvious that that indeed has been the official position of the United States government ever since.
And the corporations and the people in it have bought this lock, stock, and barrel.
That's right.
I know when I started out in medical school, I hate to say when, 1961, okay, so I've been around for a while. Medicine was not just a business. In fact, doctors were frowned upon if they advertised.
Exactly.
There were no big HMOs. Hospitals didn't own doctors' practices. And we had independent practices that let us do exactly practice the way we wanted, so long as we didn't hurt anybody. And if we did, then our medical board stepped in, and it took action to stop it.
And people never got health insurance through their businesses either.
No, and the whole business, that started actually in the 40s, Vicki. When anyway, it's a long story. But you're right, John. Medicine has become more and more a business every day.
Yeah.
I remember back in the early 1990s when I was affiliated with a local hospital out here and in a big call group and doing ICU and CCU patients and doing all the critical stuff because I thought that was the cat's meow at that time.
Right.
And I gave a talk at Grand Rounds, which is where all the doctors get together.
Right.
And what I mentioned is that if they didn't watch out, HMOs were going to be taking us over, hospitals were going to be buying out our practices, and soon we would be practicing medicine that was dictated by people who were bean counters, not people who knew a lot about medicine. So your point is exactly right. And,
exactly.
You know, just because Nixon says something doesn't make him right, but he foresaw what was going to happen. You have a good point.
Well, that's good to know that. Thanks for sharing that.
It was immediately in the aftermath of that speech that the HMOs began.
Yeah. Well, that's right. That's when the doctors' union started as well.
Right.
Because it was back at that time in about 1970 that I led a strike at Highland Hospital, which is a county hospital in Oakland.
Yeah.
And we wound up on the front page
that.
Of the New York Times. You do remember. Wow, you've got a good memory.
Where do you live?
I'm in Oregon now, but I was in Los Angeles at the time.
Uh-huh. And so we started that. And I remember going to a meeting just a couple of years later, and the union, which was a Union of American Physicians at that time, took the stand that we were going to have to start working with insurance companies and doing more of what they wanted. And I stood up, and there were 300 people in the room, and said, well, what about us being a union, you know, and acting like a union and taking care of our rights and patients' rights? They said, I don't think we can do that anymore, and we're going to take this tack. So I stood up and said, well, I'm resigning right now. I'm no longer part of this union because you're not doing your job. And I walked out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, is there any other aspect of that you want to ask us about?
I just kind of wanted to drop in that bit of history that, that it was in the early 70s that the Democratic, what was left of the Democratic Party collapsed.
Yeah.
Well, they managed to save face for a little while by going through with Watergate and driving Nixon out, but they haven't represented anything opposed to corporatism since then.
No, in fact, it's grown immensely, and now you know you can't trust Congress. I mean, look what happened in health care reform.
Yep.
Obama was really trying to bring universal health care forward, and what we got was the Affordable Health Care Act, which basically did
it's
not much
of
anything. It did a few little things, but when it came to trying to protect the rights of the people that did for health care, it didn't do that.
No,
and so what we wound up with
didn't address any of the core issues involved in actual medical care.
That's right. What the insurance industry did was spend $500 million, okay, lobbying with Congress, basically bribing them so that they would get about $1 million per person, because there are 535 Congress people.
Right.
And you put a half a million in there, it's almost $1 million a person.
Yep.
And, of course, that buys Congress. And it's the biggest swindle of all time, because we're talking about a $2.7 trillion industry that they bought for a half a million dollars.
Right.
Because they now control and they're making more money than ever.
Yeah.
Anyway, John, thanks for calling. That's good stuff. Appreciate the call. All right, the lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Spooner with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. You know, I really appreciate John's call, because he's making a point that a lot of us have started to figure out. You know, the insurance industry has never made more money than it's making today. Its lobby is really powerful, just like the pharmaceutical industry. It's outrageously powerful. And Congress, those people, I would vote every incumbent out. I don't care what their name is, what their track record is. I'd throw them out. Because we know that the Democrats are voting one way, the Republicans are voting another, and where does common sense come into it? It's not fair. And when you've got 10% of America having confidence in Congress, boy, that means 90% of people don't trust it anymore, as of course they shouldn't, because what's the real problem? They're more interested in getting reelected than they are serving the people.
Yep, that's for sure.
The lines are open. This is Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888. And we'll be back taking your calls after Vicki's final 2020 tip.
Nuts and seeds are healthy snacks, and researchers at UCLA have found that not all calories are created equal. Well, the study that was published in the Journal of the American College of Nutrition is significant in today's diet, as snack foods account for more than a quarter of the total caloric intake among Americans.
Wow, that means junk food's got a high priority in our lives and our diet.
And the study is important because it's the first of its kind to show that pistachios can be part of a successful weight management program. And the nutrition researchers found that although pistachios have more calories than pretzels, like, for example, 240 calories are contained in 75 pistachio nuts.
Oh, that's quite a number to find.
And 220 calories in 2 ounces of pretzels.
All right.
And the pistachios are healthy, and they support your body mass index.
It's a natural food.
And your heart health.
There
and
you
they
go.
Contain healthy filling fats.
Mm-hmm.
They're probably more filling than pretzels, too.
Oh, I mean, what's in a pretzel, Vicki?
Carbohydrates, and some of them I've looked at the ingredients, like on an airplane,
yeah.
They have trans fats in them.
And it's white flour and salt and trans fats.
Yeah.
I mean, if it looks like food, eat it. If it comes in a package and has things in it you don't understand what they are, that's not food anymore. That's a food product.
Well, in my opinion, pistachios taste better than pretzels anyway. But
oh,
you know, too,
yeah.
When you go to the city, they sell these big pistachios. Not pistachios.
Big pretzels. Big hot
They're
ones.
Really not pretzels. They're bread.
That's it. It's hot bread.
With salt on them.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. All right. Well, yeah, seeds and nuts are really important to be in our diet. What I say is fruits and vegetables, seeds and nuts, herbs and spices. Have a nice day. That's the recipe for eating wisely and doing the best you can for your body. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Spooner with Nurse Vicki. The number is 888-874-4888.
Well, do you wake up in the middle of the night and you can't go back to sleep? Well, how about a low-dose Ambien called Intermezzo to the rescue? I mean, it's been FDA approved for insomnia that is characterized by waking in the middle of the night and not being able to go back to sleep. But Intermezzo is not without problems and side effects.
I'll say. I mean, it's the same BS over and over.
Any way to sell a drug.
Well, it's that for sure. But it's about trying to solve a symptom without trying to figure out what the cause is and ignoring it. I mean, that's like when your brake light goes on, you put a Band-Aid over it, you don't see it anymore, so you're not distressed, and the problem continues to go on. And it's the same thing with
these. Michael Jackson.
Well, that's the extreme case, but you're
really
right.
He was really desperate to go back to sleep, to go to sleep.
To go to sleep. Well, I mean, there's nothing like not getting enough sleep. You feel terrible the next day.
But isn't there a pattern about people that are depressed about when they wake up?
Indeed.
Besides the fact that you might wake up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, and if you don't have the lights dim, you might have trouble going back to sleep.
Well, you might.
It stimulates your melatonin.
You got a good point there, but basically there are different patterns of sleep that mean different things. So when you have somebody that can't get to sleep at night, and maybe it takes a half an hour or 2 hours to get to sleep, that's because their mind is racing and they've got a lot of anxiety. And if they wake up several times through the night, it's the same thing. They've just got too much on their plate and they can't resolve their problems, and so they stay wired. And a lot of people with post-traumatic stress syndrome, people who were abused physically, sexually, or emotionally in childhood and didn't have the tools to deal with it
or
at that
war.
Time. Or, yeah, anything that causes PTSD, that would be the extreme case, is going to have a hard time sleeping. But when you wake up, in say, at 4 or 5 in the morning, you can't go back to sleep. That's a pattern that says you're depressed more often than not. It's not. None of these are always rules, but they're things that should tip you off. And if that's the case, if it's anxiety or depression or PTSD, it doesn't make any difference. You need to find out why it's like that and to deal with the underlying problem and to realize that if your problem started in childhood, which very often is the case, when we're defenseless and don't have the tools to solve our problems, by the time you can't sleep at night and you're in your 30s or 40s or 50s or worse or older, I mean, that's when you do have the tools most of the time because you're not a kid anymore and you've learned a lot of things through your life, but the triggers that you had are still there. And they frighten you when they come on, and you freak out because you freaked out since you were a kid, and now you're trained to freak out. So you've got to find a way to deal with not just understanding, but resolving those problems. And a sleeping pill is not the answer.
Well, you know, when they have all these requirements, if you take it, like it has to be at least 4 hours before
well,
you're
yeah.
going
so
to
you
get
wake
up
at 5 and you're going to get up at 8. I mean, that's 3 hours. You can't do it then, and that's when depressed people have the problem. And if you're anxious, the chances are that you're gonna be able to get to sleep if you take a sleeping pill or if you work out your problem. And if you're waking up in the middle of the night just with a lot of anxiety, yeah, you could do something like this in an emergency, but you really need to solve the problem.
Well, so let's talk about what some of the side effects are. Excuse me. Like, for example, a little bit of amnesia, like you might get up in the middle of the night and not remember that you ate or had sex or you drove the car.
Jeez,
or
if I had sex, I want to remember that. That's the good stuff, yeah.
Well, you'd miss out.
You'd miss out on, well, you wouldn't miss out on the process, I would think, but yeah, I understand.
And sleepwalking, and then you might have trouble driving the next day because it can make you groggy. You can get addicted to it.
Sure, and then it stops working. I have a few people who have been on sleeping pills their whole life, and I can't get them off. They came to me that way because I don't prescribe sleeping pills for my patients. It'd be a rare thing to do, and usually only after a pattern's been set and they're addicted. And at that point, they don't work anymore. But if you don't take them, then you have this rebound insomnia that's awful, and it takes time to detoxify from that and to break that cycle.
It can also give you headaches and nausea and fatigue and so forth. But, you know, I think it's good to talk about some alternatives to help people go to sleep without taking the sleeping pills. You know, there's things like exercise and sound healing music and not taking long naps.
Listen to some Stephen Halpern music. I mean, his stuff is wonderful. It puts you in a mood where you kind of forget what's going on. It just relaxes you. and he's got music for different things. And there are other people besides him, but I happen to know him and like him, and I like his work.
Yeah, he's great. And also essential oils can be helpful, mm-hmm. and if you meditate, you know, to help to do some of that.
Yeah, so. Do simple things that aren't invasive, that don't have bad side effects, that are not addicting, that don't knock out your REM sleep. That's another thing. The rapid eye movement, REM, rapid eye movement sleep, is when we dream. And dreaming is really important to our health. If we don't dream like we should, we don't resolve a lot of the problems that we have in our life.
Well, this kind of fits with, you know, that expression that time heals all wounds, or get some rest and you'll feel better in the morning.
Uh-huh.
Because the researchers from UC Berkeley found that our REM dream phase of sleep really does take the edge off of difficult memories.
Well, what it does specifically is it shuts down stress chemicals like norepinephrine that keep us all revved up so we can't sleep. So when you fall asleep and you have REM sleep, you'll process the emotional things that were challenging for you in the day, but with a lot less stress involved with it. So you become more objective. We know that the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that deals with emotions that are tough, quiets down when you do a functional MRI. You just see this whole amygdala not working so hard anymore, and you see the prefrontal cortex of the brain working a little bit harder. And it's the part that's the rational part that takes the edge off, the emotional edge off the problem that we're trying to solve.
And sleeping pills don't allow you to do that.
Well, they often block REM sleep, so you don't get it. And about 20% of our sleep is REM sleep. So it's really important that we get our sleep in a natural way and solve things. I know these people who, at UC Berkeley did an interesting study. They had a bunch of people who, I think 35 people that were young adults, who they showed some emotionally stimulating and challenging pictures, about 150 of them. And then 12 hours later, they showed them again. And they were doing functional MRIs on these people when they did it. So they got an idea of how they were responding to the emotional impact of the pictures that they saw. Those people that looked at the pictures, then 12 hours later, and they stayed awake in the middle of that, took it again, were still revved up about it. The people who looked at the pictures, took an 8-hour sleep, and then looked at the pictures again, didn't respond to it anywhere near as much by functional MRI testing. So we know that we have here something that's telling us a lot about sleep. It's not just resting, and it's not just restorative. It's not just rest and restoring and repairing. It's about how we deal with life. And the REM part of dreaming is a very important part that helps us solve our problems that we normally might not be able to.
That is a good expression, too, about saying, I'm going to sleep on it when somebody
yes.
wants you to make a decision
That's
about
perfect,
something. Because
perfect.
Many times that works for me. I make my decisions either in the middle of the night or while I'm in the shower.
Yeah.
I don't know what the shower has to do with it.
I know. If I have to give a speech, you know, the next day, I'll usually read a little something about what I'm going to talk about, not a whole lot the night before, and then I'll sleep on it. And when I get up in the morning and I have a lot more recollection of the kinds of things that I want to talk about, then I go to my talk and I never take a note with me. I trust myself that I've worked this through and I know what needs to be done. And it works for me.
Well, I found that it really helps me, too, when I have to learn something to read it over before I go to bed. You know, another thing that's good for sleep is exercise. Just 2.5 hours of it a week actually is significant. It also reduces daytime sleepiness. It increases concentration. And something else that might really surprise you, cramps.
Right. Right.
You know, so
there was like 70% less leg cramps if you did that. And you would think that if you're exercising hard, that maybe you'd get leg cramps. But if you get into shape and you're doing at least 2.5 hours a week, this is vigorous exercise now. It's just not lollipopping around. It'll help you sleep a lot better.
Well, you know, exercise isn't just good for, you know, our waistline and our heart, but it's good for depression. It's also good for sleeping.
It's as good for depression as the SSRI antidepressants, things like Prozac. There's no difference. Well, actually, there is a difference. Exercise is superior to it because it lasts longer. There were some wonderful studies done at Duke University probably 5-10 years ago that studied this and showed that exercise is one of the best things you can do for people who are depressed. The problem is convincing people to do it because they, I don't feel like it. So maybe what you have to do is put them in a program, you know, where they exercise.
Well, think about how it used to be when more people were working on farms and on the ranch and they're out there working hard all day. They'd always
They're dead tired.
So the number here, if you have any questions about your health, is
888-874-4888.
So let's talk a little bit about medical errors here. You know, a lot of healthcare workers are hesitant to admit and report medical errors because they're afraid of retaliation. And there's a problem with reporting errors in outpatient clinics and pediatrics. So let's talk about the study to encourage reporting errors and how many more medical errors that there are that go unreported. Because normally we say that there's 100,000 deaths a year from medical errors. So
that's a big number.
If healthcare workers are afraid to report them, we know that there's got to be more than that.
Well, if you've killed somebody, okay, because of the way you've practiced medicine,
you probably don't want to tell.
I mean, that's the last thing that's going to benefit your practice, and it's also all your peers are going to know, and the community is going to know. You know, Dr. So and so made a mistake and killed Johnny or Betty. That's not such a good thing. And in general, there was a study that was done on pediatricians in North Carolina that showed that they were having about 5 reports a year that were voluntary for medical errors, and I can assure you they were all kind of like minor things. They weren't big deals. And yet, when they did a study, when they made all the reports that would be given out anonymous, so there'd be no way anybody would know who it was, and there wouldn't be any prosecution, and they were safe, well, the number went up substantially. I think the over 2.5 years, there would have been 13 errors that would have been reported if there was 5 per year, but there were 216 that were reported. But what really gets me is they come out saying getting reports doesn't mean that medicine is unsafe. And I'm thinking, there were 100,000 people that died from this,
that
and you think that's safe.
To me.
I'd like to know what you think is unsafe. That's safe. And they said that they didn't have anybody who died in this. Well,
and no cases of serious harm.
Yeah, so it's like, I think this isn't transparent. What it's pointing out is that the practice of medicine is really tough. It's difficult.
Well, people
it's
are
too
rushing
difficult.
Around. There's distractions.
Well, look at it this way, too, Vicki. If you pass your boards, okay, you're an expert. You're somebody who's really done well. If you get 80% of those questions right, you pass. That means you don't know 20% of what you were tested on, plus a whole lot that you weren't tested on. Now, that's telling you that there's just too much to master. And if we continue this sick care system that we do, meaning we wait till somebody gets sick before we do something about it, these are the kinds of things we're going to see, because we're using complicated drugs that kill 400,000 people a year, 100,000 of which are from the expected side effects, and the other 300,000 are from a lot of bizarre reasons. We've got a problem here. We should shift the transition from sick care to prevention and wellness, that we're doing health care, not sick care. It wouldn't involve all the challenging things that we're seeing today.
Well, the thing is that according to this study that they did in this pediatrics clinic, people were much more willing to report things if
it was anonymous.
Yeah, if it was anonymous.
Yeah, sure.
The thing is how do you report these things anonymously? Because they have to do something about it. If you give the wrong medicine, you might have to do an anecdote or pump their stomach or give them, do something about it.
You know, a lot of those things just never come out. And that's why these people said they didn't have anybody who had serious harm because they had a fine hospital. Well, you know, I bet there were people that died from errors in the hospital.
I wonder if they ever tell the families.
Well, you know, some people, I would if I did that, if I knew it, but many people wouldn't. I think your relationship with your patient is absolutely sacred. You should be a good listener and you should care, which means you have to spend time with your patient, and you don't get that time.
And everybody's so suit happy, you know?
Well, there's that too, and that's a scary thing. But if you don't have enough time to spend with your patient, how are you going to do the best job you could? You won't, and you won't get the time, because time is money, and HMOs are about making profit, and hospital-owned practices are about the same thing. And it's not like service doesn't count at all. It does. But when you see 100,000 deaths, and again, that's the tip of the iceberg, and that's just what the Institute of Medicine, you know, the IOM came up with, making a prediction of how many people died from medical errors. That number could be three or four times that. We wouldn't know.
And how many were killed in 9/11?
Well, yeah, 4,000 people or 5,000 people. Now, that was a huge thing. But when you look at just non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, things like Celebrex and Advil and Vioxx. And,
don't 30,000 die from that a year?
At least 30,000 are dying every year, and 300,000 are going to the hospital. That, to me, should be on the frigging front page of every newspaper in America.
How many have died in the war?
Well, maybe 8,000 or 9,000.
So
and
this
a lot
is
of
a
interest.
Lot more.
This is a bigger, I mean, the biggest war we have.
And we're ignoring it.
Yeah, we're supporting Big Pharma. And we're doing nothing about changing the paradigm to wellness so that this doesn't happen. It's just unbelievable to me.
And this is a business? This isn't a very successful business.
Yeah, well, that's where we started out. You know, we got our call from John earlier from Oregon, who's saying medicine's a business. Well, it is. It's about profits. It's about the bottom line.
It's about money.
It's definitely about money.
There needs to be more emphasis on caring.
Well,
and taking our time and just being present and being with the people.
It's about
because
being
if
a healer.
Really present, you're much more or less likely to make a mistake.
Well, are you going to be a healer or are you going to be somebody who's a technician? That's what we're talking about. Well, I think we're at the end of our show, and I'd like to remind everybody that we'll be back live to talk about what's new in the news and health and to take your health questions every Monday afternoon on PRN.FM and on drsaputo.com from 3 to 4 Eastern Time and 12 to 1 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be archived on drsaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe, so if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
All right. God bless you. Have a wonderful week.